Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight with our guest speaker, Simon Crean, who's well known to all of you, so I will introduce him very briefly. Mr. Crean graduated in economics and law. He held a number of senior positions in the trade union movement, including, of course, president of the ACTU. He's been the member for Hotham since 1990. He was a minister in the Hawke and Keating governments and held a number of important shadow ministerial responsibilities when Labor went into opposition, including, of course, for a time, Labor leader and consequently opposition leader. But since the election of the Rudd Labor government in 2007, Mr. Crean has held the very important position of Minister for Trade. So he's welcome, very welcome back at the Sydney Institute, talking on the topic, the triumph of trade liberalisation over protectionism. Simon Crean, very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jared, and it's good to be back here at the Sydney Institute. I last spoke in 2004 and again in 1999, so they seem to go on five-year cycles. So I should be back in 2014, just keep it posted. But seriously, I do want to acknowledge the significant contribution the Sydney Institute makes in terms of promoting opportunities for addresses such as this and not favouring either side of politics. I note at the outset that there's a growing sentiment among many leading economic commentators that the worst of the recession is over. I won't go that far at this stage, but there are certainly significant signs of a world economic recovery. Beyond the coordinated economic fiscal stimulus packages and the creative work that the G20 have been involved in, I think that the lessons of this global financial crisis have also taught us that we have learned from the past. As the world plunged into recession, there was significant pressure for a retreat back to protectionism and the imposition of new trade barriers. On balance, I think that we can declare that the protectionist push stemming from the global recession has been contained. One of the key reasons for this is because of a new realisation of the importance of trade and how it is central to global recovery. Trade is an economic stimulus. History shows that world trade has grown three times faster than world output over the last 50 years, and each time that there's been a successful trade round, it has enhanced that multiplier effect. It's also why the G20 has put conclusion of the Doha round at the centre of its action plan for recovery. It's now recognised as a fundamental part of the stimulus measures and it's critical to sustained economic growth. Think about it. There's not much point calling for coordinated action on the fiscal stimulus package unless you're also going to work on the multiplier. Trade has real consequences for jobs, for incomes and for families, and it will play a critical role in the economic recovery that we all look forward to. So on the one hand, I'm pleased to declare victory over the latest bout of protectionism, but it's also pleasing that the issues of trade liberalisation and the importance of trade are now in the economic mainstream debate. The fact is, trade liberalisation and protectionism have been discussed in workplaces and over the airwaves a lot in recent times. And less than a week ago here in Sydney at the ALP conference, always a joy to get behind you, especially when you're in government. But in the lead up to the conference, And I might also say that dull conferences are good conferences when you're in government. You need a bit of spark when you're in opposition because you do need the added attention. But the conference was a success. But in the lead up to it, we heard many threats about trying to restrict trade negotiations and also pushing for a 20% advantage for Australian goods and services on federal government procurement contracts. We resisted this push in the strongest possible terms. These issues, in fact, were not even presented to the conference, and in fact, earlier motions in support of a 20% price discount for local firms on government procurement were rescinded, and a motion on so-called green border taxes was also rejected. In addition, trade was embedded, this time, in the mainstream economic chapter of Labor's platform. And in my view, this was strong backings for the findings of a report that I released in June of this year, which was the 20-year stocktake of what trade liberalisation had meant for Australia. It showed that over the 20 years, GDP growth had been increased by between 2.5% and 3%, and in income terms had delivered up to $3,900 a year on average to Australian families. What happened in Sydney last week at the ALP Conference on Protectionism and Trade Liberalisation was not an isolated incident, but it was an important signal that Australia is prepared to show leadership on these issues. So why is protectionism so attractive, especially in tough economic times? I think the main appeal is in its simplicity. Protecting jobs is good politics, but protectionism as the response is seriously flawed policy. When things are going bad, it's very easy to blame others, to blame foreigners for taking local jobs and forcing local factories to close. It's simple, but it's wrong, especially for a trading nation like Australia, with a population of 22 million people. It has to engage with the rest of the world. And the other interesting dimension of this is that already in that economy, one in five jobs is trade-related. One in seven of them export, one in ten import. And so it's also important to understand that trade isn't just exports. It's how you take an import and use your comparative advantage to value add it. Protectionism won out in the 1920s and 30s in the era of the Great Depression. The global economy suffered hugely because it did win. A recurring theme of world leaders in response to this crisis has been categorically that we must keep trade flows open. In November of last year, the G20 leaders reinforced the need for free trade, and the subsequent G20 meeting in London in April ordered the establishment and monitoring of to track protectionist developments. One of the most glaring examples of protectionism in recent times was the decision of the European Union early this year to introduce their export subsidies. We criticised this in the strongest possible terms and made all of the appropriate representations. At the time, we also said that this would invite retaliatory action, and it did. Toward the middle of the year, the US announced its own dairy export program. We condemned these moves and we continue to protest against them, but it is an example of what can happen. Subsidies further undermining already depressed world dairy prices and corrupting the market. The bad news is that these dairy export subsidies are perfectly legal under current trade rules. The good news is that under a concluded Doha, subsidies would be outlawed. Another major example of protectionism was the US Congress early this year backing the Buy America campaign, which mandated only US iron and steel could be used in federally funded projects. The Australian government again led the protest against the Buy America campaign, and President Obama showed great leadership in forcing Congress to make changes so that it complied with international trade agreements, including our free trade agreement. But so he should have, because the US had signed up at the G20 to opposing any reversion to protectionism. Again, the rules-based system, together with peer group pressure, provided an important discipline. Here at home, of course, we had the potential for the contagion to spread. The New South Wales government, in its state budget in June, proposed a 20% advantage to Australian companies bidding for state government contracts. Again, we condemned this measure when it was announced, and it still remains condemned, but because the ultimate losers from such an exercise of what I believe firmly is a misguided and flawed scheme will be the people of New South Wales, who will simply have to pay higher taxes to meet the additional cost. What has been pleasing was that there was little appetite for this direction from the other state governments. And most pleasing of all was that, coming as it did in a timing sequence, the recent conference not only didn't endorse the measure, it in fact overturned previous decisions calling for it. The containment of protectionism is arguably a factor in our strong trade performance, and I think we take heart again from the figures released today. The ABS released figures showing Australia produced record exports of $286 billion in 2008-09 and a record trade surplus of $5.8 billion. The financial year surplus of $5.8 billion is not only the first since 2001-02, it's also the largest ever on record. And it itself is a great achievement in the middle of the worst global recession in 75 years. But there will always be the threat of protectionism, and that's why concluding the Doha round is important. It's important for two reasons. One, the point I made before, trade is an economic stimulus. Second, because strengthening a rules-based system, such as the WTO, is the best insurance against protectionism. I'm pleased to say that new political momentum for the conclusion of Doha has recently been reactivated in the last couple of months. It commenced in June in Bali with a meeting that I chaired of the Cairns Group of Agricultural Exporting Nations. It was followed up on the margins of the OECD meeting in Paris in later June. It was reinforced last month with a very strong commitment of APEC trade ministers. And early next month, interestingly, India, that was a difficult country last year, is prepared to host a trade ministers gathering in New Delhi in preparation for the Pittsburgh G20 summit. So the strategy has been to try and build political momentum in recognition of the fact that that's what's going to drive the conclusion. APEC leaders also have the opportunity to discuss the matter later this year when they meet in Singapore in November. So our hope is that the renewed political momentum and the realisation that we are now in the end game to Doha will enable conclusion in 2010, as called for most recently at the G8 Plus series of meetings in L'Aquila in Italy. We've got to also ensure that these clear messages at the political level are acted upon by our senior officials in Geneva. Finally, on the point of protectionism, it's worth speculating about the future and the threat posed by the so-called green border taxes or green tariffs. Green border taxes were discussed in detail recently at a major OECD conference in which I participated, as well as the ALP National Conference. Again, there is growing international awareness about this issue and recognition that it is backdoor protectionism. As the world moves towards a global scheme on cutting emissions, there is a real need to address this issue of carbon leakage. But the so-called approach of doing it through the introduction of green tariffs or green border taxes that penalises countries that don't cut emissions is not the way to go. The implementation of green tariffs would be an administrative nightmare. Think about it. Trying to deal with the complexity of measuring carbon usage on products, it opens up this whole argument of rules of origin all over again. Then to try and set the tax rate at the border, quite apart from how you factor into the mechanism the principle of the common but differentiated approach having regard to the different stages of economic development. But on top of the complexity, there's no doubt that it would invite retaliation, exacerbating a downward spiral of protectionism. We've spent too much time and effort breaking down protectionist tendencies to create a new basis for protectionism under the guise of combating climate change. I might also observe that combating climate change should not be only seen through the prism of the threat of global warming. It must also be viewed through the prism of opportunity for growth and for jobs, green jobs. During 2007 and 2008, 441 renewables deals were announced globally with a reported value totalling $70 billion. And under the Rudd government, Australia has made a strong commitment to the environment and announced a number of initiatives to stimulate the growth of the green technology sector in Australia. Away from protectionism and onto the broader economic front, Australia is very well positioned. This nation, unlike almost every other developed nation, has avoided technical recession. Australia's GDP grew 0.4% in the March quarter, making us the strongest performing major economy in the OECD. There's no doubt that the government's swift and effective response to the crisis, with some $77 billion allocated to intervention and stimulus to support jobs in the economy, has played an enormous role. The stimulus has insulated us from the worst of the crisis. It will also put us on the front foot in readying for the recovery, but also helping Australian companies secure better market share. If we're positioned as the only developed country effectively growing, and we're in the region that itself is growing, there's big opportunity against our competitors to secure some more of that market share. Australia's stable, well-regulated banking system has served us well during the global financial crisis. Our banks are well capitalised and profitable. Of the 10 large banks in the world with a credit rating of AA or better, four of them are our Australian Big Four. We're also well positioned, in my view, because of the legacy from the 13 years of the Hawke and Keating governments that were committed to two important focuses. One, engagement with Asia. Two, structural reform. During those years, Australia did lay the foundations that have buttressed our economy during these difficult times. Under Labor, Australia undertook major economy-wide structural reforms. We internationalised and modernised our economy. Through the Accord, we negotiated money wage restraint in return for social wage improvements to lock in low inflation and low interest rates, as well as using the mechanism to establish enterprise bargaining. At the time, we were also pursuing tariff reductions, floating the dollar, opening the door to foreign banks. These initiatives combined led to the biggest step up in productivity the country has ever seen, with the Labor government of Bob Hawke and Paul Keating delivering productivity gains of more than 3.3% through the 1990s. Sadly, productivity has dropped off under the previous government because, in my view, of its failure to continue that strategy of investing in the drivers of economic growth, in infrastructure, in skills, in education, and in innovation. There was also no push by them for cooperation in the workplace to encourage cooperation based on the enterprise with the offer of sharing the rewards based on the increased productivity. I make those points because, in my view, there is unfinished business for this government, and it's why it is pleasing to see that as a significant component of the stimulus packages, 70% of the money is going to projects that have the potential to invest in the drivers of economic growth, in skills, in infrastructure, and in innovation. It's also important to note that Infrastructure Australia, the independent-based body to recommend the sorts of infrastructure projects that we undertake, is required as part of its mandate to recommend projects that improve our international competitiveness. On the trade front, we have also advocated and actively promoted a twin pillars approach to trade reform. The first pillar of reform, of course, is through trade agreements, the opening of the markets. But the second is to continue the drive for structural reform. Again, think about it. There isn't any point opening the markets unless as an economy you're productive enough and competitive enough to take advantage. The drive and commitment to structural reform and improving our competitiveness must never cease. But it's also a message not just for us. It's a message that I continue to convey in all of my trade discussions. Structural reform is an essential ingredient to sustained economic growth. For developing countries, I believe that our aid for trade focus must be much more on the capacity building opportunities to help the developing countries achieve their structural reform more effectively. Importantly, we reorientated our trade and diplomatic focus towards Asia as well, and this was underscored most effectively by our decision to create and our calling for the creation of APEC. It has its 20th anniversary this year. So in short, we opened the economy up to the world and we boosted productivity to position Australia to take advantage of the growth in Asia that we've seen now for the last 20 years. The reform and the engagement with Asia have been critical cushions for the Australian economy during the global recession. It also gives us great opportunity as Asia, now more than ever, is emerging as the centre of world economic growth. It's one reason why we've been negotiating greater access for Australian exporters to these markets, but also engaging in commercial promotion. It's also why I have constantly been on the move in the region. As Trade Minister, I've visited China now 6 times, Indonesia 4 times, Singapore and Thailand multiple times, Vietnam last month, and I also met the last couple of days with my Malaysian counterpart in Melbourne following my visit there last year. And I'm off to India next month. It is Asia where there is growth and huge opportunity with big markets. China with a population of 1.3 billion, India 1.1 billion, and 600 million people in the ASEAN group of countries. In relation to that group, Australia has signed a free trade agreement with ASEAN that comes into force from January 1, 2010. And as Trade Minister, I'm determined to strengthen and deepen our trading relationship within Asia, and in Asia, there's no bigger market than China. My last visit to China, just a couple of weeks ago, was not again to Beijing, but it was to the regions. This time with Innovation and Industry Minister Kim Carr, because we focused on the automotive sector. China is now the world's largest market for new cars and recently has become the world's biggest manufacturer of passenger vehicles. They have moved from the position of just joint ventures to wanting to produce their own vehicle. Australia is one of the very few countries in the world that can take the concept of a car from mind to showroom floor. That's an enormous range of capability within a sector that clearly there is going to be continuing demand for. Our problem is we've got the capability, we haven't got the market. China is different. It's certainly got a market, it's got the biggest one, but it hasn't got all of the capabilities. The challenge for us is to try and find those opportunities in which we can work constructively together. The scale of the industry and the speed of pace of economic development in China is truly impressive. It's not just the auto sector. The other staggering factor in terms of China is that in the next two decades they are going to have to build 400 million new homes. Think about that. That's the biggest urban development scale anywhere in the world's history. And I've taken missions up to China of people involved in design, in smart building materials, smart lighting, energy efficient housing, wastewater, all of those sorts of things. We've signed MOUs at the regional level to try and develop the basis of cooperation. I say this because China is already one of Australia's two top trading partners. It'll contest with Japan, and the next few years will be pretty interesting to watch that contest. But it is, by any stretch of the imagination, the world's fastest growing economy this year, next year, and will be the year after. It's a huge buyer of our resources, and if you think of where their stimulus measures are going, particularly into infrastructure and steel making, that draws a lot from what we can supply. Not only because we're closer, because we have a better quality of product, we are more efficient in terms of extracting it. And for all the arguments about pricing, it's the preparedness to continue looking to Australia for an important source of that supply. It's also interesting to note, going out into the regions of China, the staggering level of economic growth still in many of those regions. And it's also the case that China is becoming a more consumption-led economy, and this too will open up new opportunities for Australian companies. So my reason in mentioning that is because it is true I've been frustrated about the lack of pace in terms of the free trade agreement with China, but we've not been deterred in terms of trying to advance the relationship. Instead of worrying about what or what isn't happening in Beijing, we've been prepared to get out to the regions. And that's why I've travelled to China to promote agribusiness in the Yunnan province, sustainable urban planning in Wuhan and Yunnan, and most recently autos in the Anhui and Hubei provinces, as well as the follow-up memorandum of understanding of urban planning. We have to identify the sectors. We've got to identify our strengths, and we've got to engage at the commercial level. So it's really a two-track approach. Getting out into the regions, promoting commercial links with provincial governments, as well as negotiating with Beijing. So to close, we are resisting protectionism, but also actively championing trade liberalisation. The task ahead is to conclude the Doha round at the multilateral level, to conclude and consolidate the negotiation structures, particularly the coming into force of the ASEAN Free Trade Agreement on January 1, and ensuring that the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a grouping of nations within the APEC region, and the PACER Plus agreements, which is here in the Pacific and being discussed in Cairns as we talk, are important opportunities in a regional sense. At the bilateral level, we're pushing on with negotiations with Korea, Japan, Malaysia, Indonesia, China, of course, and we concluded last year the FTA with Chile. It is a cascade approach, using regional and bilateral opportunities to build on the platform of the multilateral round and build in a way that is WTO plus. The push to liberalise global trade is a never-ending challenge, but I've got the perseverance and persistence to keep it moving forward, and I'll do that. There is no alternative. I now look forward to hearing your questions and views. Thank you.
Do you want a glass of water, or are you okay?
No, I'd like a glass of water. But Carol's got one there. It's good.
Carol's got a glass of water, dear. Amazing. Many thanks to CAWS for the use of this facility this evening, and so we come to question and discussion. We'll finish no later than 7 o'clock. You said you're off to India next month, and you mentioned India in your speech. As you know, unfortunately, the Prime Minister cancelled his one scheduled visit to India, and perhaps he's going again soon. And there's been a lot of, in your speech, there's been a lot of emphasis on China, and rightly so, but do you think there's much more the government can do about our relationship with India, and is there more the government should be saying about our relationship with India? Because, as you pointed out, the Chinese growth, but Indian growth is not... projected growth is not that far behind the Chinese projected growth.
Yeah, I do. I think that the relationship with India is one of the most underdone of our trading relationships. Interestingly enough, it's been the fastest growing market, both in goods and services, over the past 12 months, but off a very low base. I think it was the other PM that actually effectively cancelled the trip because he had a bypass or something at the time, and that meant that the PM who was planned to go there didn't go. He plans to go later this month. But I really believe there is particularly strong opportunity in India because it's a much more diversified economy. It has a strong services sector, it is a democracy, and it has a system of governance and language that is a lot better to connect with for Australians seeking to do business. One of the areas of opportunity is in infrastructure, because even before the global financial crisis, Manmohan Singh had identified the infrastructure deficit in India, and they had committed significant resources. They've been complemented by the fiscal stimulus packages. The difficulty, it's still going to be a hard market to crack because there are a lot of interests that they would classify as sensitive, and these have to be worked through. We've undertaken a study with the Indians to identify the potential for the relationship to go forward, and whilst I'm going to India essentially to try and make sure that this meeting of ministers can drive the Doha round forward, we've also got scheduled an important bilateral meeting to see where that relationship might go. I think, though, that when you look at what India is doing and where there are complementarities with Australia, the big problem with India is that there isn't a good enough appreciation, I don't think, by India as to what the diversity of Australia, what the diversity is that Australia has to offer. So one of the things that we are trying to activate with China is a CEO's engagement with India. It's a bit easier with China, there are fewer of them. But with India, a CEO's forum, and the reason this is important is that whilst trade negotiations are very much government to government, the economic drive is really the business to business connection. So we can do all we can on the G2G front. We've got to encourage much more interaction on the B2B front, and then working together, I think we've got to try and join the dots. That's how we will advance the relationship, and that's what we're seeking to do with India.
The question is, in the context of India, does the minister think that the controversy about Indian students in Australia is going to affect the relationship between the two countries?
I'm confident it won't, if we understand that it is very important for us to get on top of the bad examples. I've already had discussions with my counterpart and did. Immediately the time this issue blew up, the Prime Minister did, so did Stephen Smith. I've discussed it directly with Anand Sharma, the new Trade and Commerce Minister for India, and also Julia's going there later this month. It is very important that we get on top of this, I think, for two important reasons. One is parents who send their kids out want to be assured that they are going to be safe, not intimidated, and all of those sorts of things. And that's a natural thing. And for a country like us, you know, we take it for granted. We would think that that'd be the last thing they'd cop here. So the fact that it's happened is all the more reason why we've got to try and protect the image. The other thing, I think, is the brand. Because one of the great Australian exports now is education. The challenge for us, and why we haven't made more inroads, quite frankly, is that many countries protect the public dimension of education in terms of institutions. They don't easily allow the transplanting of the physical infrastructure in other countries. We've been able to do it in Malaysia, some parts of Vietnam, but not in China, for example. And it remains to be seen where we get with India. But I really think that two things strike me when you look at the Asian region, the Commonwealth countries in particular, the significance of that Colombo plan and the people-to-people links that that created and the commitment to this country because of the values, combination of values and opportunity that was given. This is a vital brand for us and we have to protect it. We have to promote it, but we have to protect it. So I think that it is really important, and I know Julia is paying a lot of attention to this issue, that we really need to ensure that if people are letting the brand down, that we move quickly to either ensure they shape up or they don't, or they ship out. No, I don't. And I wish I did. And we continue to ask. No charges have been laid. We understand from reports that it is having been in receipt of state secrets, not intelligence now. So it seems to be not in the field of espionage, but state secrets. What are the state secrets? We don't know. This is a important issue for us because any Australian citizen, no matter where they are, if they're arrested in a foreign country, they're entitled to support, and we have been making active recommendations. The problem is that under their legal system, they have acted in accordance with it. It's not our legal system, but then we wouldn't expect people coming here to operate as if the country from which they came should apply to them. So I think it's a salutary lesson to all who work and live and operate in other countries that they do have to have regard to the law. But that having said, it would be a lot better in terms of the relationship if they proceeded expeditiously, if charges were to be laid, that they were more forthcoming with the information such as the question that you've asked, and of course that they be afforded the appropriate consular access, but also family access and legal representation.
Question right down the back.
Yes.
I think the big criticism of where we are with China is that the previous government gave away what China wanted most and didn't get anything in return. They conceded market economy status, and practically ever since, until we sought to revive it last year, the negotiations haven't gone very far. I don't argue against the principle of going forward and having to ultimately concede that point. But I do think that you've got to be a bit more adept in the negotiating field and make sure that you've still got coinage. As it turns out, I think that there is still important coinage with China, not the least of which is resources, and their requirement for those for a long time into the future. Not to try and secure any special treatment in terms of price, because my point back to them is, well, if we've conceded you are a market economy, then act like one. And let the market determine what the price is. But I think in terms of long-term supply and reliability, that's important. The other thing that I think is important with China, as it will be with India, is the fundamental significance now of services in two-way trade and the opportunity. I happen to believe that the great opportunity, whatever our arguments about agriculture and manufactures are, the big opportunity is in services, because services is 80% of the Australian economy, yet it's only about a third of our exports. And the other big thing with China, which there has been a lot of discussion, is investment. But the point I've sought to make to the Chinese is that investment, as much as you want to make investments in this country, and increasingly so over the last few years, investment is a two-way street. And our businesses want the opportunity to also make stronger and bigger investments in China. So investment is a two-way street. We should get a framework, and that should be part of the FTA too. So to answer your question, I think that there is big opportunity, if we're prepared to embrace it, big opportunity to secure and reinforce the growing interdependence between our two economies. And that's what I would like to achieve. Now, as for, I think, the broader part of the question about do we still support FTAs, we've never said we didn't. But what we have said is that really, FTAs should fit into the framework as part of what I refer to as the cascade. By far the biggest opportunities for us and global economic recovery come from securing a multilateral outcome, but multilateral outcomes will never be the perfect outcome. There will always be carve-outs and limitations and timelines. So what you should be doing is trying to secure the best possible outcome at the multilateral level, then using the regional framework to enhance it, and use the bilaterals to enhance it further, so that you've really got WTO plus plus. That's what we've got to strive for, and in that structure, FTAs can and should play a very important role.
Question in the middle there.
Yeah.
Thanks for mentioning services there, Minister. Services are the future of this country, and your government can't support grants to allow aspects of the services community. I'd like to find out from you what to be doing so that the companies can continue to offer their exceptional services, especially when they're faced with cheaper resources in some of these countries we're talking about.
I must say, I'm not too sure what the services assistance that we cancelled was, but I... Research and development grants. But the previous government did all of that. We're trying to pull it back. I mean, and I think if you look at the most recent budget, we put a lot of money back into innovation, research and development, and we've also put money in, importantly, into the Export Market Development Grant Scheme, which was seriously underfunded by the previous government. So, look, I think that government support is important, but the challenge in terms of services is that most of what you try to get in isn't restricted by a tariff. It's the behind-the-border restrictions, the limitations, the regulatory framework. And so what we've got to do is to drill down into the importance of it. The other thing that I think we've got to do far better in terms of our services sector is to demonstrate the significance of our comparative advantage through the services dimension. Take mining and take agriculture. It's not just the commodity that we have comparative advantage in, it's the way in which we produce it, the way in which we extract it, the way in which we value add it. And in many cases, that's a combination of technology, smart technology, and application, whether it's software or whether it's the innovation base. I was out at a veterinary facility today, Parnell Pharmaceuticals, and they are a classic example of it, because what's the strength of our beef production and our dairy herd? It's the efficiency with which we produce it and the leading edge technology without any subsidies. How does that happen? Doesn't happen unless you've got a service base committed to experimenting, to continuing to punch out the new frontiers. So I think that there is a huge opportunity in the services sector. It's something in trade terms that really hasn't been tackled in a way before, but interestingly, in the Doha round, services not only have got a run, there's been a very important, what's referred to as a signalling conference, to identify what countries are prepared to do as part of the conclusion, not just in terms of moving goods, but how we can facilitate a greater flow of services.
Now we're getting at the end, so we've got to be quick. There's a question here, we've got to be quick.
Yeah. Considering what you described about the industrial and economic expansion in the world, how could we ever satisfy the next 50 years the energy requirements, especially petroleum?
Well, I think you move away from petroleum, and I think gas is a good case in point. And Australia is hugely endowed with this, and interestingly enough, with Malaysia, the joint partnership between Santos and Petronas will see the largest shipment of coal seam gas in the world. That's already been contracted. I think if you look at Australia now, it's very interesting. You've got the North West Shelf with all of those huge developments of offshore gas. But in Queensland, and down, if you follow that coal seam down into New South Wales, there's huge potential for coal seam. In many senses, if you leave the coal in the ground, it's probably the cleanest version of coal extraction of the lot, because it doesn't burn the coal, but it takes a gas stream off it. The pipeline and the infrastructure is there, and it is forecast that that deposit in Queensland coming down into New South Wales is, if it realises its potential, will be bigger than what's on the North West Shelf. Now, interestingly enough, I think that gas is one of those great commodities that will benefit most from an emission trading scheme. Because if the emission trading scheme is properly structured, it should reward good behaviour in terms of the environment and at the same time punish bad behaviour. So in relative terms, gas versus fossil-based options, gas is in a very strong position, and it's why you're seeing a lot of investment down here now, not just by Australian companies but foreign companies that don't just want the resource, they want to do the value adding here. And if you think of Europe and the difficulties that they've had in terms of the supply from Russia and the pipeline, they are actively looking at alternate sources of supply. So I don't underestimate the capacity and the ingenuity of people to find more efficient and cleaner systems, but it will be enhanced and it will be expedited far more effectively if we get a market system that drives it. And that's why we are pushing so hard and taking the lead in terms of Copenhagen.
Final question here. Got to be brief. What's going to happen about exporting uranium to India in view of their non-proliferation treaty? And if we've got a right to export it, then export it there. Perhaps we should use it at home for nuclear power. There's a question about exporting uranium to India, and secondly, the possibility of developing the uranium industry in Australia.
On the second part of the question, I think there is a question as to whether we should develop it here, but we don't agree with it, and we don't think we need it, because we have huge resources in terms of alternates and cleaner options. As for the question of supply to India, our position also is quite clear on this, that we supply uranium, for example, to China, to Russia, because they're signatories to the NPT. India isn't. And that's an issue that still has to be resolved. The question of the uranium resource and the and our, like a Labor government's preparedness to accept the expansion of that isn't in question now, because that was resolved at an earlier ALP conference, and I think that what was a three mines policy is now probably, I think it's six already, isn't it? But and with the change of government in West Australia, one would assume there would be more interest over there. So I think, and if I can just make this final point, whilst I don't think we need to develop a nuclear industry, and whilst we are rigid in terms of not supplying to countries not signatory to the NPT, I think as the major supplier, one of the major suppliers of uranium in the world, we are in a very strong position to insist upon its use only for civil purposes and in accordance with the strictest safeguards. So we're in a position to influence, importantly, that direction of a global response.
Just a final quick question to take you back where you started. As you know, when you first became a public figure, the trade union movement was protectionist. The Labor Party in opposition was protectionist. The Fraser government was protectionist. What do you think changed all those attitudes as somebody who played an important part in some of those organisations?
I think, I mean, if you look at the history of this country and what's divided politics, it's been white Australia policy and tariff. And I think that what taught us after the war to ultimately end the white Australia policy was that increasingly we found that attracting migrants and bringing them here was the best thing in terms of the development of this country. It not only enhanced our economic development, it enriched us culturally, and it taught us to understand much better the importance of global engagement. I think the trade front was the natural extension of that, but it took boldness of government to do it. And I think it needed a cooperative approach, given the protectionist tendency of the trade union movement, to convince them that there were benefits from engagement. You think about 83, when Hawke came to office, the prevailing economic orthodoxy was supply-side economics. It was Thatcherism and it was Reaganism. It was only the Hawke government that stood out and argued a different approach, an inclusive approach, an approach that said, we have to globalise, we have to engage because our future is dependent upon it, but if we're going to do it, we've got to take the mob with us. And if we're expecting to get them to make the individual sacrifices, we've got to find clever ways to strengthen the social safety net. Now, I think those things in politics are fundamental. It's the issue that China is going to have to grapple with. It's the challenge that China got confronted with in terms of this latest economic challenge. How do you put stimulus in by giving money to people if their whole instinct, because there isn't a safety net, is to save it? So they will only spend if there's confidence that the system will look after them. Fortunately, Australia has such a system. It has it because we embraced the age pension 100 years ago. But the biggest intergenerational policy of our time was no doubt the implementation of national superannuation system. How did that come about? Because it was the trade-off for wage restraint. And what we delivered in terms of low inflation and low interest rates, laying all the basis for that, we traded off in terms of something that was not money wages now, but security and income into the future. I think it is the great legacy. The only question now is 9% enough? I don't think it is, so how do you do it? These are the new challenges, in my view, coming out of the recession. But I believe, even at the Labor conference now, Jared, you talk about protectionism, everyone talks about it in the lead up to the conference. I think so far as protectionism is concerned, we've killed it off in the Labor Party. I hope we've killed it off globally. But unless you take the boldness of decision and really say, this is the way to go, there are going to be benefits, and then continue to sell the benefits, then I think you get away with it. Our difficulty in 93, probably in the 90s, was to assume that people could see the benefits. And when we lost office, there was a lot of complaint that people didn't think it flowed through. Well, the lasting legacy is there. We're too small. You can't just produce for a domestic market anymore. Globalisation came upon us, and I think that this country was just lucky enough to have a government that saw the opportunity and went right after it.
Many thanks. Well, we're right on 7 o'clock, so I'll be very brief. Once again, thanks to the cause for this fine facility. It was significant to hear the Minister speak out strongly on the Stern Who case, and I'm very pleased he did so at the Sydney Institute. And I'll just make one final comment. Following Simon Crean's career over a long time, both in the trade union movement and more recently in politics, and there's evidence that what he has many skills, but one of them is an enormous ability to grasp detail, and you need that in the trade union movement if you're arguing about awards, and you need it in trade if you've got the patience to argue about trade negotiations, which is a very special skill, but for a nation like Australia, a very important skill. So it's great to have a trade minister who's so competent in this area. So well done tonight, Minister. We'll hope you're back sometime in the future, perhaps before 5 years. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.